Well, I'd like to welcome everyone to Spotlight. Today we're honored to have as our guest Lieutenant Colonel Decker, better known as Jim J. Steve Pelt will be doing the interview. I'd like to thank both of you gentlemen for your help in making this a success, as well as I'd like to thank Dennis, Rebel, and Jeff there for doing the recording. Steve, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Michael, and welcome everybody to a special spotlight. It's November as we record, and this is the last spotlight we'll have before Remembrance Day. It's a very big event over here in the UK, and a very big event over in the United States. And today we've got someone's story who hopefully you'll find fascinating, and he's a very courageous and brave man, as you'll find out during the course of the next little while. Jim, can I start, as always, by asking you to tell us a little bit about your early days, and where and when were you born?
I was born in Trent, Texas in 1920. Trent is in Taylor County. I don't know much about it. We left there very early.
And where did you move to after a short period?
My family moved to Southern California, down below Long Beach, and that's where I first have memories in that particular area. That's my first memories.
Can you give us a feel for the area? What sort of a community was it you grew up in as a small boy?
It's a community, a seaside community. And my father, at that time, was working in a lumber company. And it was while I was an infant, I guess I was about maybe 4 years old. I had a younger brother, roughly two, and an older sister, 2 years older than I am. We had been there only a short time. I remember some of it, but at that time I became aware of the fact that my father had disappeared, and that was my first inkling or any knowledge if there's any problem in the family. But our family broke up at that point, and I was a very small kid. My mother then took the three kids, and we got on a train, and we ended up in Oregon with my maternal grandmother.
So you moved around quite a lot as a small child, obviously, and you settled. Tell me a little bit about your mum. What did your mum do for a job, or did she just stay home?
My mother kept us kids together, of course, and we stayed with the grandmother over winter. And after the winter was over, we went back down south. And along about that time in that area, sometime, we acquired a stepfather. And stability came into our lives. The stepfather bought a couple houses with money he had, and I was then raised in that one house, in that one location, all until the time I moved away and married. I went to the same schools all the way through, and that provided me the early stability in my life, and it was beneficial, of course, to the whole family.
Yeah, of course. You mentioned your school days. I take it that you went, because you haven't always had a sight problem, we'll come on to that a little later. So you went to ordinary school with ordinary kids, and did you enjoy your school days?
Yes, I sure did. I went to the local grammar school, and I enjoyed that very much. I was a good student, I had no trouble with the studies, and it was just a great, great thing for me. And during that time, you know, as a youngster, I was able to engage in hobbies that I really and dearly loved, and my early start was very, very good in that respect, and I'll always be appreciative of my stepfather.
As a boy, Jim, you were telling me you had some really interesting hobbies, and just tell us a little bit about your hobbies. What did you like to do as a small boy?
It might be of interest to folks that as a young kid, I liked airplanes, model airplanes. I built model airplanes. I built some just for hobbies to look at, you know, interesting to look at, and I built others to fly, and I competed. My greatest interest was the competition, of course. But I've built models of World War I airplanes, you can imagine. One of my favorite ones was the German Fokker D-8. It was an interesting one to build and interesting. But for flying, I was able to win some of the meets. We would meet as boys and had an organization, and we would have a timer. A fellow would check our aircraft. We would launch our aircraft and time its flight time. And of course, the longest flight time would be the winner. And I was fortunate enough to win on occasion. On one occasion, a small little pusher that I had designed and built myself got into a wind current, and it was time. They lost sight of it at 5.5 minutes. Of course, I was on its tail. I ran several miles before it finally came down and for me to retrieve it. But that's the kind of hobby I had at that time. After that hobby, a little older, I went into racing pigeons. That's a wonderful, wonderful hobby for a young kid. That's a marvelous hobby. Racing pigeons served me for a hobby that kept me occupied until I was in high school.
Ah, racing pigeons. Now, that's a big hobby over here in the UK. That's where you tell us how that works, Jim. Tell us how you race pigeons.
Well, you have to have a loft, of course, for your birds, which I had. I built it, and my stepfather helped me. And I accumulated some homing birds. You can't just fly any bird. You got to have birds with homing instinct. And there was a man in the neighborhood that helped me a little bit, helped me acquire some birds with the homing instinct. And then what I had to do, I joined the pigeon racing club. There were young people. There were some older people in it, too. And it was not beyond my means. I didn't have any real income or anything, but I did a little odd jobs and so forth for pigeon feed and dues and sort of that sort of thing. But I had to have my loft surveyed. So we had to have an official surveyor do it. What he does is takes the location of your loft where you're actually measuring from the street corners, and he uses a map, and then he measures the direct line from your particular house to the Railway Express building in the various towns that you're going to race from. And I was in Long Beach, and so our race stations were, first of all, Bakersfield, 125 miles, Delano, 150, Tulare, 175, Fresno, 200, Merced was 250, Modesto was 300, Marysville, 400, and Redding, California was 500. Now, I raced two different races. There's the young bird in the fall of the year. Those are all birds hatched out after 1 January. And you fly those in the young bird races. And you only go up as high as far as 200 miles for the young birds. The old birds, they fly in the spring and through the summer. And you fly them from the first station up through the 500. And I had birds come home from all of those stations, and I won several races very happily. It was a wonderful time for me and a wonderful hobby. Any young man that can do that should be well satisfied. It keeps you busy, and you're off the streets, and you're active and happy pursuing something that's most, most interesting.
I'd say I had a really good time flying your pigeons, and you obviously enjoyed it very much. How did you manage to finance your hobby of racing pigeons? I imagine it must have cost a little bit.
Sunday mornings I had a paper spot in downtown Long Beach. I sold papers and I did odd jobs. And there was also a dump near my junk where they dumped trash and so forth. And I could go through some of that trash, and there was a particular jar that I could get 5 cents each on such a jar if I could gather them and find them, and I could turn them into the store. I was amazed that those jars were there, but nonetheless, I got quite a little bit of money out of those things, enough to feed my pigeons, believe it or not.
Very enterprising, Jim. Very good indeed. Okay, now we've said that you enjoyed school and you obviously progressed through your education. When you left school, what did you do as a job first after leaving school?
I worked in sheet metal. I was going to become a journeyman sheet metal worker, but that was waylaid, and I became a journeyman retail meat cutter, a butcher shop operator. That's what I did for a little while.
And during this period, I think you told me that you were fortunate enough to meet your wife. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Well, I met her in grammar school. We were in the same grammar school. Of course, she was just a snot-nosed little girl then, you know. I wouldn't have anything to do with her in school. But after we were up in high school and older, she became quite attractive to me, yes. And when I was 20 years old and she was 18 years old, we were married. And that then means that my birthday, which was just last month, was my 84th. And 4 days later was our 64th wedding anniversary. There's only been one wife, only one marriage. We've been together all that time.
That's absolutely fantastic, Jim. That's really lovely, and many congratulations. And what's your wife's name? We can't keep calling her your wife, can we? What's the lady's name?
Her name is Annabelle. She prefers to be referred to as Anne, so that's what we call her. She's a very marvelous lady.
And I believe you have some children, too?
We had two. We have a daughter who's now 61 and a boy who's 52 years old. The daughter lives nearby. I'm currently living in Colorado. I've been here 12 years. Both the daughter and the son are living here. They live about 75 miles east of us, but near enough we see them frequently.
That's lovely. Around about this period, of course, World War II kicked off over here in Europe, and then I think one day in 1943 you got a little invitation, didn't you, Jim, through the post?
Yeah, I received a note, a postcard, and it said, "Greetings, you have been selected by your friends and neighbors. Report to." So I thought, some friends, some neighbors. Well, I did the reporting too, and they decided that they could use me, and like they were using others. In fact, when they got through, they had gathered together and used some 16 million of us. So I was drafted on the 8th of January, 43. So I had, after Pearl Harbor, there was approximately a year and a month or so before I was called. And I went into the Army at that time.
So from what you're telling me, you were actually conscripted. You didn't volunteer. You were actually told you'd got to go. Did you have any choice about which service you entered? Could you have gone into the Navy or the Air Force? Or was it your choice to go into the Army? Or did they tell you where they wanted you to be?
Once you receive a draft notice, you have no choice. But beforehand, I could have gone to the Navy or the Coast Guard, and Marine Corps, so forth and so on, but I had no interest in military service, and so I just decided, well, let the chips fall where they may. If they want me, they'll call me, and if they call me, I'll go. So that's the way it was. And I was called by the Army, and I went. They sent me I did not go to a basic training center. I was sent directly to a battalion that was in training and was filling up. I was a filler, and they devoted each day, well, I imagine must have been 150 or 200 of us that came in the same as I did, and so each day, instead of going into the normal things that battalion would do, they set aside about 4 hours in the morning for those people, and we had basic training along with the regular troops that were there. And that's how we got our basic training, and that went on for several months. And in the meantime, the battalion was continuing to train for its basic mission, too.
Just going back before you went away on your basic training, how did the family react when you had this this call up, I mean, they must have been very apprehensive. Can you remember what sort of conversations you had between yourself and Anne?
Oh, yes. My wife was pregnant, and we wondered what the heck we're going to do. And so my wife's grandmother and my wife, they went together in a small little house. They rented that, and they lived together during the war. And so that took care of where she was going to be and how she was going to live. And then, of course, when we were drafted in those days, the pay was $50 a month, and they took from me $28 and put $22 with it, and sent her $50 and left me $22 for my things that I might want while I'm in the Army. So that's the way it was in those days. And they got along all right on that money. They didn't have anything. Well, they didn't have any real wants in those days. Don't forget, we were in a long depression there, and we were used to not having anything. So nobody was too excited about the fact that life was sort of slim. You know, we always had enough to eat and a roof over our house, and we had clothing on our back, so we thought we were well off.
And had you got any children at this time? And if so, how old were they?
Well, our first child was born in 43, May of 43. So I went in January 43, and then just 3-4 months later, our first child arrived, our daughter.
So there you are, a young man, and you're summoned off to war, and leaving a wife and small baby behind, and then off into the unknown. Tell us a little bit about your basic training when they first started to train you. What sort of things were you doing when you very first went?
Well, you get your usual basic training. First of all, you got to be able to listen to ordinary commands. You got to stand in formation. You got to learn to march and so forth and so on. That's the basics. And then you'd move into individual training, advanced individual training, and then you'd move into the particular area that you're going to be serving in, either on a gun or on this section or that section, whatever you're going to do. If you're going to be a crew member, or you're going to be in a squad, whatever you're going to do, you'd move for your advanced individual training there. And of course, shortly thereafter, we're moved some, 2,500 miles into Tennessee doing maneuvers in Tennessee. And we went through quite a bit of that.
Did you find it tough? You know, did you find the Army life grueling, you know, when you first joined up?
No, I had no interest in military service at all, and I heard people griping and so forth and so on, but somehow or other, the particular life, the discipline, etc., seemed to suit me, and I seemed to fit. And fitting, it just didn't bother me, and the job we had to do, wherever it was, I went after it and did it the best I could, and did it as quickly as I could, and I learned fast, and as a result, I was promoted to corporal soon after I'd been in the service.
That's very good. And how long did the basic training take?
Well, the basic training we were getting within the battalion was probably 6 to 7 months. And then the battalion went on major training in the desert in Southern California, and we didn't have any separate training. We just went into the full mission of the battalion, everything that the battalion is supposed to be doing. Our basic was taken care of. We had to perform like everybody else in the battalion, so there was no more separation of those fillers that came in when I came in. We were just members of the battalion from then on out.
So after this basic training, then, when they thought that that Jim Decker was ready for seeing a bit of action, where did they send you?
We then went to New York and on a ship, and we landed at Greenock, Scotland. I'm sure you know where that is. And we were boarded on the LMS and railed down to Bridgewater in I forget the name of that county, Somerset County, and we arrived after dark. Trucks were there, and they hauled us out to a place in the country, and there were tents out there, and they put us up out there, and then the following day we can look around and see where we were. We were on an estate. It was called Brymore House, and we had a lot of tents put up out there, and we used the big house too. It was a big 600-year-old house, carriage house, and other buildings. We used all the buildings there, and that's where we were for the 4 months that we were in England before the invasion.
Tell me a little bit about your trip over from New York to Greenock in Scotland, which, just for record, is probably about, I don't know, 400 miles away from where I'm sitting now. Did you come over on a large ship? And just give us a little bit of an insight into your journey over here.
Yes, we came on the Duchess of Bedford, a British ship. And, of course, people hadn't been on ships before, and there was a lot of seasickness, a lot of problems like that. But none of that ever bothered me. The ships never bothered me. I never had seasick or anything else. It was all right for me, but there was a lot of sickness. It took us about 10 or 12 days before we reached Greenock. And at Greenock, we were disembarked, and it was very pleasant to see the green of Scotland when we arrived there.
Yeah, and then you traveled quite a few miles, because it's a long way from Greenock to Somerset. It's quite a journey, and where you were describing where you were actually based. How were you received by us UKers? I hope we made you feel welcome, Jim, back in 1943. Were we good to you?
We were treated very well and welcomed very well, and my particular job had changed somewhat. I had been promoted again, and I was in, they put me in battalion supply, and what happened then is we went overseas with just ourselves our kitchen stuff and things of that nature, and never even had our individual weapons. And in England then, we had to submit requisitions for all of our equipment, which was the system they used. And the depots were full of the equipment expecting us to draw them. So as a battalion supply sergeant, then I prepared the requisitions and submitted them. And then we would await a release, and when we received a release notice, it would tell us that we had X number of this or that to pick up in Taunton or in Wim or over in Cardiff and so forth and so on. And so I would then arrange a truck convoy and the number of people, men we needed, and the vehicles, and we'd go get the stuff. We go get all our guns and that sort of stuff, and then get the other stuff that we need. And that was what we're doing initially. I was on the road a lot the first 2 months. And then when we had our equipment, we did amphibious training.
So just to put the guys over your side in the picture a little bit more, that means that you were driving or traveling, you know, quite large areas of the UK. And you got very close to where I'm speaking to you from now. In fact, you did tell me one little place that you visited, Burton-on-Trent, is only just up the road really from me. So you were very nearly in my backyard. Well, I wasn't here. I wasn't even born. But you travelled extensively in the UK. Just as an ordinary American guy, young American guy over here, what did you think of us?
Well, I thought they were wonderfully committed to the war. All the Brits that I ran into were well committed, and they were friendly, and they were helpful. If I asked for directions and so forth, occasionally I got the wrong road, and I was going the wrong way. Well, the Brit would straighten me out, and I'd get the convoy turned around and go back, and we'd get going, get it going the right way. Not too much of that, but some of it, and they were very helpful. And I can tell you, on one occasion, I had six two-and-a-halves, and I was in a Jeep, and I pulled the convoy over for a break, and I didn't notice that there were trees along the road there, and we were near a break in the trees, and I didn't notice, but up in that break, up in the hillside there, was a beautiful home up there. And while we were sitting there, a woman came down from that that house, and she came to me and she said that she would like to invite us all to come up to her house for tea. Well, I thanked her profusely, but there's no way I was going to allow all those guys to go up to her house, because I don't know how long it would take to get them back out of there and back in those trucks again. So I thanked her, and I thought it was a marvelous, marvelous gesture that she was willing to take a driver and an assistant driver out of six trucks. That's 12. 12 plus my driver and myself, 14 people into her house. But she was that friendly.
That's nice to know, and I'm glad that people were helpful to, you know, give you directions, because I think I'm right in saying that during the war over here, all the signposts were removed, so that if we did get invaded, you know, the people that invaded wouldn't know where to go, because there'd be no signpost to direct them. So I think I'm right in saying that. I think it's a well-known fact that all the signposts on all the roads were removed. So no wonder you had to ask for a bit of guidance on occasions. So you were racing around, grabbing all the equipment and getting everything ready. Did your training continue as well at this point, Jim, for the rest of the guys?
Yeah, you're always training. You're going over your weaponry. You're going over your tactics. You're going over everything you're going to do. Going over your camouflage nets and so forth, all that stuff. Where you had a gun, you had to have a camouflage net and so forth and so on. Always, always training, and then we went down to Slepton Sands, and you probably know where that is, and we went on what was called Exercise Tiger. It was the 7th Corps practice invasion, and we loaded up full bore of ammunition, full combat load to go, and went down to a little port there and loaded up on these landing craft, and they set to sea. And in the night, they made a feint toward France, directly toward France, and then they came back toward England, and they landed at Slapton Sands. But on the way back, a German motor torpedo boat, they called them E-boat, slipped in alongside the convoy and put a torpedo on the boat that was right ahead of us. It was an LST right ahead of us, and sunk that thing. And there was all hell breaking loose there for a bit. It seemed to me like everybody's dog was firing everything they had to fire at whatever it was they were trying to hit, and I never did see an E-boat. I could hear it roaring and roaring, but I don't think anybody saw the damn thing, but they were all shooting at it wherever they thought they were shooting. And, well, the ship sunk, and there was a wrestle there. The rest of the convoy, of course, just kept going. But 2-3 weeks later in Stars and Stripes, there's a little article indicating that 317 men were lost at the Exercise Tiger when the boat was sunk.
Yeah, terrible, terrible experience for those guys. And again, just to put it in a little bit of perspective for the guys on your side, so you actually set out on this exercise and you had a practice run and you went out to sea and then came back and landed in the UK on similar terrain, similar beaches to what you would find when you actually went for real. I think that's right, isn't it, Jim? Because the coast was very, very similar across the other side, so you could have like a simulated run at the real invasion.
Correct. In fact, the area we landed in, called Slapton Sands, I don't remember the actual name of the places, but they had beautiful homes along the road there, and they had fired artillery, destroyers fired into the ground there and fired into these homes. Beautiful big brick home there with a big hole blown in the front of it there. There's a lot of sacrifice among the British people during that war. And then we came ashore and went up into a village there, and they had booby traps, and the booby traps were arranged so if you foolishly trip one of them, it would give you a smoke bomb or something like that, but not much of an explosion, but it would sure show you how stupid you'd been. So it was good training, very good. And then into the village, it was the house to house and down in the street stuff, that kind of fighting and so on. That was really, really realistic.
And then a few weeks later, in June 1944, you did the invasion of Europe, Normandy landing for real. Before it started, were you aware of what you were going to be doing? Did anybody actually tell you the gravity of the situation, or were you just given orders a few at a time and you just said, okay, well, this is what we've got to do at this moment and we'll worry about the next lot of orders later? Or were you actually aware of the gravity of the situation, you know, the mission you were setting out to achieve?
Well, we knew we were designated for an invasion because they had they reorganized our outfit, and they had beefed us up with a heavy concentration of mobile machine gun mounts was added to our equipment, quite a bit more firepower, and we knew we were going, and we knew we were going to be an invasion battalion. We didn't know exactly where we were going. We didn't know where we were going to fit. But as it turned out, we were a D-Day battalion on Utah Beach, which was very fortunate for us. Just 2.5 to 3 miles to our left, Omaha Beach, we lost about 2,800 men or so down there. They came ashore on a beach that had a high bluff, about 100 feet high, back of the beach. And the Germans were up there on a maneuver, just practicing for just such a thing as an invasion, and lo and behold, there it was. So they're firing down on these guys trying to offload and get into that beach. On our beach, it was flat, there was no bluff, and there was, about 250, 300 yards in from the seawall, the area was inundated. It was a low area, and the Germans had flooded that. They diked it and flooded it. So anyone coming through there would have to stick to the road, period, you know. And so what the Germans did when this actually happened, well, they were laying fire on that road all the time to keep you there. But the paratroops that were landed inland beyond the inundated area in St. Mary Glees and Santa Maria Dumont, just inland there, made it tough on the Germans on their artillery, and it was not all that bad for us. In fact, it was very darn right easy in comparison to other places. The most bothersome fire was coming from our right, which was up the peninsula, not from dead ahead. It was bad, but it wasn't all that bad, you know. And we didn't lose very much on the beach, some, but not much.
Tell me a little bit about the trip over there. I mean, there you were, a young guy again. I keep emphasizing this, a young guy in your 20s with a wife and baby at home, and you were in real danger. Can you remember what was in the back of your mind? What were your thoughts as you actually made the trip over before all this started to happen? How do you cope with that situation?
Well, there's a clearing station right there on the beach, and they're bringing people in there trying to doctor them. They're dying there, so they're just laying them on the sand there, laying them out on the sand. There's probably 40 or 50 dead guys laying there, and it was quite obvious that you could get hurt around there, but I don't know, it just didn't seem to sink in too much that we had our job to do, and we did the job. If we had had to move forward here, we did. We did what we were trained to do. We didn't slack. We didn't lay back. We didn't try to avoid. We did what we were ordered to do and what we were trained to do. And our training really stood us in good stead, because we knew what to do, and so we did it, and everything turned out okay. My battalion didn't lose all that many. We probably lost 20% of our battalion, but that's not too bad.
You make it sound very, you know, matter of fact, but it must have been absolute carnage. It must have been absolutely terrible going through that. And the weather didn't help either, did it? Because we've just obviously over here had commemorative programs on TV and radio about it, because it's just over 60 years, just 60 years and a few months back. And I know the weather was bad, wasn't it? And it nearly didn't happen. It was nearly called off because of the weather. Do you remember it being particularly bad?
The sea was a little rough, and that's the only thing that was bothering. Ashore it was all right, but the landing craft, we had difficulty getting ashore. Our landing craft struck an underwater object, and by the time they got it off, what they do with those craft like that, they drop out an anchor and let a cable roll out behind them on a winch. And this guy pulled in his winch and backed us off it. And what we were over one of our own 2.5-ton trucks that was under the water there. And so we moved over and made another run for it and reached the beach. And when they dropped the rank, a Jeep was up front. This guy took off of this Jeep and he went into a hole, and he's in water up to his waist in that Jeep, and he's hollering for help. We couldn't help him. We just back away and find another spot. We finally, the third attempt, we did reach a solid area on the beach, and we were all able to get off there, get up off the beach and through the seawall and back and spread out where we can spread out. There was artillery fire keep bouncing along through the beach there.
And you were under constant bombardment from the Germans trying to prevent this actually happening. You had to disembark from the ship, didn't you, and get onto a smaller craft, which actually took you just the last few hundred yards onto the beach. Were you physically in the water, or, you know, as you made your way up the beach, or were you in a vehicle?
Yeah, I was lucky. I was in a vehicle, and I stayed in the vehicle. I didn't get wet or anything. It was relatively easier. Utah Beach was relatively easy in comparison to, Omaha Beach, and then on further on the British Sword. I forget what the others, the Sword, and I forget the name of the other one, but the British and Canadian beaches were a lot tougher. We were just very, very lucky. Suffered greater during the Battle of Bulge, which was later. We had greater casualties there.
So, all in all, Jim, how long would you say it took from the time that your particular group, not everybody, but your particular friends that you were actually with, how long did it take from the time you started to land to the time you felt that you'd actually landed in France?
Well, the landings stretched over a period of time. In fact, we had one battery of our outfit was on a ship named the Susan B. Anthony that had been converted, and it was sunk. And they were fortunate enough to have clambered aboard a British destroyer or a corvette or something came alongside, and they were delivered ashore the next day. They had no equipment at all, and they went to the clearing station there where the dead were, and they picked up weapons there. That's how they were resupplied with small arms, and they didn't have any equipment at all, just the clothes that were on their back. But you had a lot of these little things happen. There are contingencies that occur in a war like that that you can't foresee, so you just do the best you can.
I'm curious about the mundane things. It's all very well, you know, having these battles and things, but you've got to eat and sleep and things like that. How on earth did you manage to sleep? You can't go on day after day without any rest or any food. Just tell us a little bit about the practicalities of it all. How did you eat, and where did you eat, and what did you eat for that matter?
Every soldier carries 3 days' rations with him. I had one D ration. That's nothing but a chocolate, 3 chocolate bars, and a C and a K. That was our rations in our pack. And then nobody's expecting to feed you. You got to take care of yourself. If on the landing craft, if you're dumb enough to sit there and eat your operational ration before you get ashore, well then, and you don't have anything to eat when you get ashore, that's your own tough luck. But I ate mine in an orderly way, and I didn't have any trouble with food. In fact, food was the last thing in the world that I was interested in.
I imagine that is the case. But physical rest, I mean, how on earth did you manage to grab any sleep? You can't go on forever. Were you designated sleep periods?
At night, you got a sleeping bag. If you still had a sleeping bag on a truck somewhere, you could get in the sleeping bag and try and sleep under near a truck in such a way that you don't get run over. You've got to be careful what you're doing. You just got to find a place until you can get somewhat organized. You just got to do the best you can wherever you are. Yeah, you got to go to sleep because you'll fall asleep sooner or later. And so you get your sleep where you can. You organize among yourself, and you guys try and get some sleep, and we'll stay awake. That's the system you use.
It must have been tough. It must have been really tough conditions. I can't imagine what you went through under those circumstances. So after you actually landed, the next few days, then I suppose were you pushing forward into small towns and villages? Is that how it was?
Yeah, everything became quite orderly, you know, after about 3 days on the beach. Moved forward, and the first town there was Sainte Marie Dumont. Well, it wasn't damaged much. Round through there, and then if you remember the war at all, the object there was to capture the Cotentin Peninsula with Cherbourg out on the end there. It was a big seaport area, and I was to drive across. The objective was to drive across the base of the peninsula and to cut it off, and then to roll it up. And then the object then was to get all you can ashore and organize as best you can, which they did, and then to turn north and move across France. And on the 25th of July, I remember the date, the bombing of St. Lô took place. And St. Lô was a town at the base of the peninsula. It was looking down on a map, it looked like a spokes of a wheel, the roads running into St. Lô. And that was a sight that we'll never see in this world again. There was at least 1,500 four-engine bombers, along with probably 400 to 500 two-engine bombers, bombed that whole area through there in a designated area. And we were standing on a hill watching that thing. The ground is trembling. We're probably 5 miles from it. But that was a terrible, terrible scene. And we watched those aircraft coming in. There was probably 30 or 40 in a group. And as they swept over the area to drop their bombs, the first groups, we would watch, and we'd see a plane start dropping out of a formation, and another one dropping down, and another one dropping down. We watched them, and then we counted the parachutes as the guys jumped out of them. And we knew that there was 10 in a crew, so we'd count them. And the first groups that went through there, they lost, you know, 4 or 5 planes here and there and so forth. But about halfway through this bombing, there was no more fire from down below. They were really hurt down there, and when we went through there, oh, there was German equipment and German tanks and trucks and everything all over the place. So that was quite a feat by the Air Force at that time.
So these were American aircraft, were they, Jim? Were these American bombers?
There were 8 Air Force bombers, all of them from the 8th Air Force.
Yeah, now you'll have to explain. You have to be, because I've no I don't understand warfare, shall we say. So the aeroplanes were bombing the town, and were they opening the way for you guys on the ground? Was that the purpose of the mission of the bombers? Were they just opening the roads up for you so you could make further progress?
Yes, anybody here remembers the history of World War II will remember that General Patton was a famous name in World War II. He was nowhere to be seen up until that time. The Third Army had come ashore and was not engaged, and they had placed themselves when the bombing of St. Lô took place. They led the attack, the breakthrough, and then the Third Army was on the go. They ran across France very rapidly.
And where was your next port of call, if I can put it like that? Where were you aiming for ultimately at this stage?
We moved steadily across France up into Belgium, and then we ended up with the 99th Infantry Division up there, and we're down in the Ardennes Forest area, and they were all along the Siegfried Line there. They did some fighting up around the Hürtgen Forest area in Aachen. But they were not getting much done. It was sort of not, there was not any spectacular movie. It more or less had slowed down a lot whole lot. And we're more or less in winter doldrums, just more or less patrolling and so forth. No major fighting taking place. Other fighting, but not any major attacking and so forth. And it was during this time in December of 44, the Germans mounted their counterattack through the Ardennes. And our battalion was overrun by German armor. And those were very, very tedious days trying to stay alive, believe me.
Yeah. Did you ever go to Paris? Did you ever get to Paris with the army? Were you involved in the liberation of Paris?
Well, the French had troops there. They had an armor division. Leclerc was an army division commander. They moved him forward and let him go into Paris first. We went through Paris, but I was in Paris a couple of days. But we went on out of there and moved on north.
Yeah. So after that, you went through Belgium, and I think you were involved in a battle of famous bridges, Jim. Just talk us through that. It's a very famous incident. A film was made of this incident called A Bridge Too Far. And again, we've just had lots of commemorations over here. Just fill us in on that topic.
No, we were not up in Holland. The 17th, 42nd, 101st were dropped along there, along with the 1st British Airborne. The Bridge Too Far, the British 1st Airborne Division virtually lost on that. We were right in the Ardennes Forest when the German counterattack took place and overran our battalion. That was south and east of Market Gardens, what you're talking about in Holland, that operation.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I misunderstood. So you weren't personally involved in that. So apologies for that. I thought you were, but you did tell me that you had had experience round about this time of the infamous buzz bombs.
The buzz bombs were coming up through the Ardennes, and they obviously shoot them things down. But when the Germans counterattack came through there, they expended so much. We lost a lot of people, but the Germans lost a whole lot too. And the Battle of the Ardennes, I think, is what broke the Germans back in the West. Afterwards, in January, we began the counterattack and never slowed down after that. We reached the Rhine and were able to capture the Ludendorff Bridge and get across the Rhine very quickly. And our battalion was across very, very soon. I remember that very well. In fact, in writing never-ending stories, I did write a little story about the that particular area at Linz, a little town, L-I-N-Z, spelled the same as the town in Austria. It's upstream from the Ludendorff Bridge. I was in that village. And when the bridge fell in, the bridge finally fell in the water, but we got quite a few across.
Yeah, is it around about this period that the Battle of the Bulge took place that you were speaking of earlier?
Then the Germans were, they were cut off and stopped. Their advance was cut off. They kept fighting their way back to get back into Germany, and it was defeated and blunted and so forth. They lost a lot. We lost a lot. But their losses crippled them, I believe.
Yeah, and finally, Jim, you actually made your way into Germany itself, didn't you? After a period, you actually ended up travelling across Germany. What did you find when you actually arrived in Germany? What was it like?
Well, as you moved toward a village or a town, you know, and all the bed sheets were out the windows, and they're surrendering, they're no more fighting. And German forces, some of them still wanted to fight all the way down to Austria, but gradually some of them got smarter and smarter and finally quit. The German people were all right, you know. They were weary. They were war-weary and ready for it to stop. And they were all right. I'm having trouble. I ran into German people, and I talked to them, and occupied their buildings, and on Linz, I ordered people out of their buildings so we could use them. That was not a very popular decision on my part as far as they're concerned. And 5 years after the war, I went back and called on that house and talked to that lady again. She remembered me, and she was quite friendly, and she realized it was all a contingency of a war, and that I had my orders, that I didn't abuse her in any way, but I did kick her and her husband and her daughter out of their house, and we took it over for 3 days.
5 years later, you went back and received a warm welcome. What were you actually doing in the house? What did you use the house for?
The house, they had a little bit of a shop-type area there, and it had grounds with outbuildings, and I wanted it for a place where it was on the east side of the Rhine, and we wanted to move up ammunition, POL, and rations, and we wanted to have a place for where we can distribute there into the firing batteries, you see. And that was an ideal spot. It was on the eastern edge of this village, and it was just an ideal thing for us at that particular time. We didn't need it long, but we just needed it for 2 or 3 days, because we're moving on east and over the hill, and we would be gone, which was the case. And so I told her when we were getting ready to go, I sent for her, and she showed up. I told her, I said, here's your house. You're all right. The house is still here. And there was a woman locally there that did the talking for us. You know, she interpreted for us. And she just said goodbye. Good riddance.
Okay, Jim, let's move it on a little bit now. When did the war actually end for you? And how did you hear about the end of hostilities?
We were down near Austria, way down beyond Munich and so forth, and we had a radio, and we heard Winston Churchill came on from BBC, and he announced that the Germans had surrendered and that all forces were to stand down. Don't fire unless fired upon. If the war is over, but keep your guard up.
I bet you breathed a huge sigh of relief at you'd come through it relatively unscathed, although emotionally I should think you took a bit of a battering. Then how long was it after that before you were sent back to the United States?
November, all the way from May until November. They sent us back to Le Havre. Well, first we did occupation duty near Nuremberg, in a small village of I can't remember. Don't remember the name right now, but it was a little town that was a controlling town of a particular area, like a county seat, and we occupied that, and they did patrol duty and just checked and so forth. There wasn't anything about it to speak of, because we didn't have any problems. And then from there they started breaking the unit up, taking so many men, say high point men. Sent them to England and then go on home again, go right back home. And then the low point men, they brought them in from other outfits and put into our outfit. And then people at the high points, I was over 85 points. I had 93 points. I had 85 or more to go home. Well, I was then moved with a group, and we moved down to these cigarette camps in France. I think it was Lucky Strike or Paul Mall or whatever. Anyway, down there they processed me, and then I got on a ship with a bunch of people and went back to the States. We got back to New York, and then by aircraft they flew out to the West Coast, and so I got home in November.
On your way back home, you know, on the voyage back to the United States, I imagine you were with lots of American forces personnel. What was the mood on the ship? Were you somber or jubilant or what? Can you remember the feeling of you guys returning to America after the end of the war?
Well, all the speculation was initially an atomic bomb of all things had been dropped in Japan. Now, is that going to mean we're not going to have to go to Japan? Are we going to go to the station? Are they going to keep us in the service and then take us to Japan? Or what's going to happen? It was all that speculation. We just didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah, but fortunately for you personally, you didn't have to go to Japan, and you know, we all know how things progressed from that point onwards. How long were you actually away from the United States? You know, from the time you set out from New York Harbor to the time you returned to New York Harbor, how long was that?
Just about 2 years.
And of course, during this period, you hadn't seen Anne or your children. What was it like when you actually got home? Can you remember the homecoming, physically walking into your own front door?
Well, yeah. I came to my mother's place. I didn't know where my wife lived. She lived in a different town, you know. She'd been moved. And my sister took me out there. She just dropped me at the front gate, dropped me off at the street, you know, in front of the house. And she said, well, she's home, so go on in. And she drove away. So I went in and kissed my wife and said I was back and so forth and so on. I was really happy to be there.
I bet you were, Jim. I bet you were. Had she got any idea you were on the way, or was it a total surprise?
Yeah, she knew that the war was over, and she knew that I was probably coming home, but I couldn't write her a letter and have the letter be there in any timely way. I write her a letter all the time, but any letter I would write would not have been timely. She just knew that people were coming home and expect me any day, and so that's how it happened.
And when you actually arrived back, you know, after the initial jubilation and relief, did you find it hard to settle back into a normal way of life?
Very hard. Very hard. I didn't settle back very well at all. And I was too restless. And I concluded that I had gotten so used to the Army that it is bothering me. And so I re-enlisted and went back into the Army.
So you rejoined the Army. Not straight away, though. There was a period when you were trying to find employment or doing jobs, wasn't there, Jim? You didn't join straight away, did you?
Oh, I didn't have any trouble finding a job. I found a job, no problem there. But I was not happy in it at all. And so I just stuck it out for a while, and it was just not good. Not good for me at all. And when I concluded that I was not going to have a happy life here, that it was causing trouble between me and my wife. I wasn't happy with that or anything at all. So I told her I was going back in the Army. She was not very enchanted over that prospect. But I told her, well, that's what I'm going to do. And so I went down and signed up, and away I went.
And what year was this? What year we're talking now?
47.
1947. So the war had been over a good couple of years, but you tried to settle, but just couldn't. So you returned to the Army. Did you return with the same rank that you left with?
They made me take one less. I went out with two rockers. I was a tech sergeant, and they made me maybe take one less coming back. Came back as a staff sergeant, but I came back intending to put a solid effort into everything. And I didn't think that I would stay a staff sergeant very long, because I intended to work and to move ahead. That was my intent, that was my objective, and that's what I did.
So where did you actually end up, Jim? Where did they send you? When you rejoined the Army and you were settled again, where did they actually dispatch you off to?
Germany.
What a surprise. So you ended up back in Germany. What was your role this time in 1947?
I was sent, of all places. I was amazed. They sent me to a quartermaster school in Darmstadt, Germany, and they made an instructor out of me on supply procedures. So I studied and went over these things and prepared lesson plans and so forth, and I was an instructor in supply. But prior to that time, I had I had answered a circular. I had replied to a circular. And about that time also, I received notice that I had been appointed a second lieutenant in the reserve, in quartermaster of all things. I don't know how all that came about. I've never been in quartermaster at all. Had nothing to do with quartermasters. But anyway, that's where I was. And so here I was. I was an instructor at the quartermaster school. I was a staff sergeant to begin with. And I had a piece of paper that told me I was a second lieutenant in the reserve. I had little knowledge of what the hell that meant to me.
goodness, yeah. I get totally confused with ranks of military personnel over this side in the UK, so I've got no chance of understanding your ranking system. So you've got two systems, a little bit like us. We've got the reserve and your regular soldier. And you were one rank in one and one in the other. Is that right, Jim? You'll have to forgive me for my lack of knowledge here.
So what happened is that I was promoted to tech sergeant, calling different. And I got that rocker back, and I was called into the headquarters over there, and I was told that the Army needed help with the Berlin airlift, and that I had a reserve commission as a second lieutenant, and that I should apply for call to active duty. And I said, "You mean to tell me they'll call me to active duty?" "Yes, indeed. That's why you have the reserve commission. You have the background, the experience, and so forth they need. So you apply." So I said, "Okay, fill out the papers." And so I did. And lo and behold, they not only called me to active duty, they put me right in the middle of the Berlin airlift. They put me in charge of one shift. I go to work at 8 in the morning, and I work to 8 at night, and then I'd be off 24 hours, and come to work 8 at night and work until 8 in the morning, you know. And the Berlin airlift ran 24 hours a day, day after day after day, if you remember. There was a load of material being carried into Berlin by aircraft. It was one after another. Every few minutes, an aircraft would land in Berlin, and one would take off in out of Rhein-Main.
The Berlin airlift, I think I'm right in saying, was to assist and help the German people with food, etc. Is that right, Jim?
Yes, food, primarily food. That's the whole thing. It was dehydrated food. And what we would do is that they would bring in their boxcars, and they used this tractor trailers business that we had, and they put this, they'd load the trucks from the rail. They'd load in a U-shape in that big truck bed, 16,500 pounds of light. That's dehydrated this and dehydrated that and so forth and so on. And down through the middle of that U, they'd fill in 5,000 pounds of heavy. Flour, sugar, lard, and so forth, the heavy stuff. And then they would put a mousetrap on the side of that trailer, telling what was in it, and the tractor would pick it up, and he'd shoot over to Rhein-Main with it, and he'd park it over there, ready to be loaded on the airplane in the same configuration. So when the planes are ready, the trucks would pick that trailer up and move it over, back it up to a plane, and then a crew would take it and put it in the airplane the same way it's in the truck. And off it'd go to Berlin. And over there, they'd take it off in the same way, and then they'd distribute it to the people over there. And that went on 24 hours a day. It was snow, and it was cold, but they just kept doing it. And that broke the Russians' effort to blockade us out of Berlin. They were not successful. We were able to beat them.
What was the reaction of the ordinary German civilian population to you at this time? Did they look upon you as a friend by now, or did you still feel hostility?
No, we didn't have any hostility toward the population. We mixed with them, they mixed with us. Well, there were some hostile types, and they avoided us, and so we didn't have any problem with them.
That's nice to know. Thank goodness we're all reconciled now. So you continued in the Army for several years and did this and that, I imagine. But then I think you told me in our pre-interview that you noticed a little bit of a problem with your eyesight towards the end of your Army career. How long did you actually serve, Jim, in the Army all told?
I was in my 22nd year of service when I had to be separated because I was legally blind. I began to have a problem, and I had a retinal detachment, and so they worked on me, and they fixed it, they thought, and so forth and so on. But altogether, I had almost 17 months in hospitals while in the Army, and it was a very difficult time for me, very, very difficult. I'd been very active, and I had had important jobs, and I'd worked hard at them, and I'd been promoted. And all that work I'd done and the efforts that I'd made, the progress I'd made, it's just too bad. It's tough stuff, buddy. You're blind. You can't do anything now. So that's what happened to me.
It must have been a terrible shock for you. As you say, you'd seen all that service during the war, and you'd done all those things, and here you are now with a sight problem. Did you have surgery to try and correct it, or wasn't that available in those days? What was the treatment they tried to give?
As I said, I had over 17 months in the hospital. I had 11 times at surgery, never sick a day, and they were unable to completely save the eyes. One eye had to be removed. The other eye, the retina was still there, but a glaucoma had created a scotoma, blocking out the central light, sight, so I had little or no sight out of the thing. I had some peripheral sight, which enabled me to move around. I could navigate around all right, pretty good, you know, but I couldn't do anything in detail. I couldn't read, I couldn't drive, I couldn't do anything with critical vision at all. So there's no place in the Army for me, and it was a terrible blow to me because I had worked very hard, and appointed originally a second lieutenant in the Army Reserve as a reserve officer, but when I was a captain, I was integrated from the reserve into the regular Army. They discharged me and gave me a new serial number, a shorter serial number, and I was a member of the regular establishment. All that was lost. All that effort that I put in, all that heavy work and hard work, and gone. Nothing I could do about it. My reputation as somebody could get things done didn't mean anything anymore because I was blind.
Again, I can hear it in your voice. After all these years, it's still very emotional for you, you know, the fact that you put all that effort in and ended up with a sight problem. It must have been a really bad period of your life, but I know you're a very resilient guy, and I know you overcame it. Were you offered any rehabilitation at this time, Jim, you know, after you left the Army? Did the Army look after you, or were you left to civilian care after that point?
Well, I was sent home, and I went home and I stewed, but I didn't have anything for a bit. Didn't do anything, didn't hear from anybody, but then they came around and they sent me to the Blind Rehabilitation Center in Menlo Park, California. To learn to live as a blind person. I learned orientation, mobility, braille, and some other communication skills and social skills as a blind person, and so on and so on. But as I have come to view life, my first life ended on the 23rd of December in 1965, and my current life began the following day in 1965. My current life is the life of a blind man. My other life was the life of a soldier and growing up and so forth and so on. And I liked my life as a soldier. I didn't like it at all in the beginning, but I became very acclimated to the service. I was adapted to it, and the Army liked me and treated me very well. And it was a miserable shock to me to be summarily booted because I was legally blind. But since this second life has started, I've learned a lot of things about me that I didn't know before, and I'm quite happy with my current life. Although I'm 84 years old, I don't have a lot left, I'm sure, but nonetheless, I have an excellent wife, a wonderful wife, and I have a good home, and everything's quite good for me. So I just don't have anything to complain about.
That's lovely to hear you say that, Jim. But it must have been, I know it must have been a terrible trauma in your life. So after you'd been to rehab and learnt a few skills of how to live as a blind person, did you consider finding any employment? And if so, what did you end up doing?
I was approached, made familiar with a program called the Business Enterprise Program for the Blind under the Randolph-Shepard Act here in the United States. Blind people operate snack bars and cafeterias. And I thought, well, hell, I can do that. I can operate a snack bar. So I responded to that. So I went in that for a while. I operated a couple snack bars. It was fun, really. I wasn't too concerned with how much money I could make or anything. I was successful at it and made money at it, but I didn't try to make a lot of money. I had people working for me. I paid them a little more than I should have, but doing that, they got the money out of the place more so than I did, but it didn't make much difference to me because my income doesn't need any supplement. I'm all right with what I've got. You know, I don't need a lot of money, but I have an ample amount as far as I'm concerned from particular life that I want to live. So, that's the way it turned out for me, and I enjoyed the snack bar business, but what was happening is that we found ourselves working too hard, and my wife was trying to work with me, and I find her all pooped out and so forth, and I thought, well, hell, what am I doing this for? You know, and why am I dragging her through this? I don't have to do it. She doesn't have to do it. So I notified the Business Enterprise Program that I would like to terminate. And so we arranged a replacement to take over. And he inventoried and paid for the inventory, and I walked away. And that's what we've done. We went up to Idaho, lived up there for a while, and I did a lot of fishing and garden and so forth and so on. And then when most of my friends died off over there, I came over here to Colorado to be near our kids.
Just briefly, I'm fascinated by the snack bar because we don't have anything like that over here in the UK. You don't get blind people running snack bars and kiosks and things like that. What sort of things were you selling? Just briefly, what sort of items were you selling in your snack bar?
The items I was selling were candy and cookies and coffee and soft drinks, sandwiches, all that sort of stuff.
Well, okay, just curious, my own curiosity, because we don't have that sort of scheme over here for blind people at all. So eventually you moved to Colorado, where you live now, and I think you told me on our pre-interview that just a few years ago you got involved with a centre for people with disability. Just tell us a little bit about that project.
Yes, locally, I was contacted by the Veterans Administration. They sent me to the Blind Rehab Center in Palo Alto in 1995. And I ended up with the Arkansas Open Book Reading System. I never heard of anything like that before. Anyway, I brought it home, and a girl I knew saw on television that this Inter Center for Independence had the same piece of equipment out there, and she told me about it. And they were telling her on the television and demonstrating the thing that it could be made into a fully functioning computer. So I went out there to talk to them and find out what they're talking about. And sure enough, in my own instructions, there's a paragraph telling me that all I needed to make it a fully functioning computer was a telecommunications program and a word processing program. And I would have a computer. It would be a DOS, be a small, low performance, but it would be a computer. So I went ahead and did that, and I got started in computers that way. So being acquainted with the Center for Independence in that way, the people out there cornered me and asked me if I would consider serving on their board of directors. I said, well, what would I do? Well, we need people that have disabilities and people who have had experience and so forth, and you might be a good one for us. So while I made the application, I went before them and explained who I was and where I had been doing and so forth, and so they voted to accept me on their board. I served them 6 years, and during that time, I became their recording secretary. I was the only blind person aboard, but with my computer, I could handle that job without any problem. I did their minutes and their correspondence for the board. And then I spent 1 year as vice president and 1 year as president of the board. And after 6 years, I decided that that's about enough. They needed some younger guys on there, get somebody younger. And so I decided to leave. So a couple of years ago, I did that. I still go out there. I still I go out for computer users group. We meet and talk about computers and what you know that's new. Do you know how to do this? You know how to do that? Will you show me how to do this and how, so forth? We learn from each other, and we just keep plugging along. And it's a place where anyone with a disability can go out there, and they got people that will help them. They have one program, just as an example, called the OIB program, Older Individuals Who Are Blind. And they've got people will go into the home, say you've got a woman, a widow woman. She's now 70 years old. She can no longer see the markings on her microwave oven, and she can't handle that washing machine anymore. And there are other settings and other things that she just wish she could do something about, but she can't. But from the Center for Independence, those people can show her how to mark it and show her how to read it, even though she can't see. So that's the sort of thing goes on down there. They teach the computer, they teach Braille, and they teach other skills for disabled people.
A very worthwhile project to be involved in, obviously, Jim, and you've got lots of pleasure out of it. I can tell, again, with the enthusiasm in your voice that you really enjoyed your time there. We're coming towards the end now, Jim, of the interview, and I'd just like to ask you, looking back on your 84 years, with all your wartime experiences and with all that's happened to you after the war, what would you say you're most proud of?
Well, I'm most proud of the fact that I made my way in the service. I made it without a college degree, and I made it by diligent work, study, and developing the resources within me to be able to handle the jobs that I had to undertake, and competed favorably with those from West Point and colleges that were commissioned, and then jobs similar to mine. I was able to keep pace and to compete favorably with them and to advance just as they did. So I am quite proud of the fact that I was able to do that. But I've been always aware of the fact the only way I was able to do it was by hard work and constant attention to duty.
Very, very admirable you've done that duty, Jim, over the last 60 years, definitely. I feel very humble. Can I just, you know, from where I'm sitting, can I thank you personally and all the guys that were with you and who didn't come back, and the guys that did come back to the US and to our side as well, because if it hadn't been for people like you and your bravery and your commitment, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. There's no doubt about that. And as I said at the beginning, it is near Remembrance Day, and I think, you know, we ought to just take a little minute to think about how lucky we are. I know at the moment the world's in a terrible mess and terrible things are going on now, but, you know, you guys were outstandingly brave, and I'd just like to say thank you. And if you can hear any noises, it's fireworks at this end, it isn't guns. That's the end of the interview. Thank you very much, Jim Jay. And can I ask again, if anyone in the room has any questions for Jim, I'm sure he'd be willing to answer any comments, or if you have anything to say to Jim Jay about his experiences during the wartime and after. But thanks very much, Jim. You're a great guy.
Jim, I'd like to thank you myself for all that you have done, and thank all of the brave soldiers who went over there.
Thank you, Lee.
Good interview, Jim. Good interview, Colonel.
Thank you very much.
It was a great interview, and many, many thanks from me as well, Jim, and all the vets and all military people fighting for freedom. God bless everyone on Veterans Day. And Steve, great job to you too.
Jennifer?
Thanks, Jennifer. And they really are brave guys. They really are.
Jim, as a service brat, I'd like to thank you and tell you that my daddy's gone now, but listening to you makes me extremely, extremely proud. And that was a beautiful interview. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have to say a belated happy birthday to Jim, too. And he is our most senior member. He beats Franklin out by 11 days. Happy birthday.
Thanks a lot.
Happy birthday, Jim.
You.
Hey, Jim. Your birthday today, huh? Happy birthday, Colonel.
Thank you. It was last month, the 22nd of last month. I was 84 then.